Testing.
Now, separate sheet of paper, because I might not get around to spelling that after Mr. Yorke.
His first words, because he hears them. First...
That's it. I just wanted to set up so I don't have to worry about it anymore. All right, Mr. Buxton just told me, and it coincides with exactly the point at which I had planned to begin. You're studying now industrialization. Well, when industrialization began in this country, it primarily had a need of what? And manpower. Manpower. To develop all of these things. Well, there wasn't all of that manpower in this country. It's a very, very large country. And all you have to do is take a trip across it, like I did with my family last summer. And we covered 12,000 miles. We were in 28 states. And I feel that I've seen just the surface, sort of skimmed just the surface of this country. So naturally, it wasn't all as thickly settled as it is right now. But the big basic industries were beginning then, and it needed a great deal of manpower. Labor. Now that broke, you could break that down into two categories. If they were going to develop big industries, and remember this is a country, particularly at that time it still is, but at that time especially was it rich in resources, undeveloped. It was a brand new country being developed, a very big country with a great many rich natural resources. So developers needed two categories of workers, skilled and unskilled. Both of these categories were recruited. In other words, people went over to Europe. Why Europe? Because at that time, Europe was the most highly developed industrial country. It had the greatest number of skilled people in certain countries of Europe, because there were certain parts of Europe that were still just one stage above a feudal state, still very much dependent on agriculture. Most of the people were farmers or peasants. However, some of the most westernmost countries in Europe, notably the Scandinavian countries, Sweden in particular, and then Germany, France and England, they had a great many skilled people there. They were recruited, but because they were skilled labor already in their own countries, they had means of coming over here on their own. They were able to make a sufficient amount of money at that time to pick themselves up and come and settle in this new country. So that again, this could be broken down into two categories. There were those who were sought after and were recruited and brought over. And when the word spread, there were then others who felt, now here is a good place to go, because here's an opportunity for me to make a lot of money, to actually become wealthy, to become, and people at that time wanted to accumulate wealth, as even now primarily, we don't think so much of accumulating a great deal of wealth outside of certain categories that I'm not going to go into, but people are primarily looking for security. And that's why they would want to accumulate material things that would ensure them in their old age. And primarily, if they had enough money, then they wouldn't have to worry what happened to them if they got ill or if they got too old to work. So that many of them then, very skilled laborers, came over on their own. But the big mass of laborers, particularly unskilled labor, did not come over of its own volition. And that's the category that I'm going to speak to you about, because I think the other about the skilled labor is kind of self-explanatory. Whatever industry developing here needed skilled labor, they sent people over there and they got them, they recruited them, either by paying their passage, agreeing to give them a job, agreeing actually to what they would be paid when they got over here. Others came of their own free will to fill vacancies that were needed here. But most of the common laborers did not come from these countries. They came from other countries that were not industrially developed and where living conditions were extremely hard. And I want to tell you about that, because about that I know from first-hand knowledge. I was born a son of peasants in the Ukraine. It is one of the Slav countries. If you have studied Europe and you know Central Eastern Europe, it's made up primarily of Slavic peoples. They're the Ukrainians, Russians, Belarusians, Czechs, Slovaks, Poles, Bulgarians, some Slovenes. You don't have to put all of this down. They form the central part of Europe. And certain one of these Slav countries were fairly highly developed, but they were very, very small. Czechoslovakia at that time, known as Bohemia and Moravia, was fairly highly developed and had a lot of skilled labor because it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at that time, very close to Vienna and very close to the large Germanic cities where industry had developed. And it was developed also in and around Prague and among the Czechoslovaks. How did these people come over here, and why did they come over here to work? They came over here primarily because agents of the various big industries that were being developed went over there and recruited them. For example, my father, he came over here because agents from the coal mines came to the part of the Ukraine where we live, and they recruited people. They paid their passage from the village in the Ukraine all the way to the town in which they would be working. In this case, it was northeastern Pennsylvania, right near a big city called Scranton, and the little town in which we settled was Taylor, Pennsylvania. That's northeastern Pennsylvania, and this is the heart of the anthracite or the hard coal region. It extends down that great Lackawanna Valley from Carbondale all the way down to Hazleton and Shenandoah, down near Pottstown, in the going towards the southwestern part of Pennsylvania. They were brought over here, they were assured jobs, they were settled in these communities and given these jobs. Why were these people so ready to come over here? Well, I told you they were peasants. And today we saw a film about Abraham Lincoln, the Civil War, the Confederacy, and the emancipation of Negro slaves. They were given their freedom. Well, we know now, because we read in the newspapers, that over 100 years later, the Negro people down south still don't have freedom in the sense of the word. Because it's one thing to say that you are no longer a slave. That doesn't necessarily make you a free man, because if you're just free from slavery, but not given any land on which to work, not being equipped with any kinds of tools, you are hardly a free man, because you are still very much dependent upon your former slave owner to give you the security, or at least a little kind of a job where you can make enough money on which you're going to be able to purchase the necessities of life. Well, it so happens that in Central Europe, serfs, they were called serfs, but they were also just slaves. They belonged to the wealthy landowners. And I assume that they belonged to the part of history, when you say American history, where there was a fight against feudalism, where the bourgeoisie rose and defeated feudalism, but it didn't destroy all of its aspects, and serfdom remained for quite a while afterwards. So they were serfs or slaves. My great-grandfather was still a slave, or a serf. My grandfather was born when my great-grandfather was still a serf. But when my grandfather was a child, the serfs were freed. But they were freed the same way in which the Negro people were freed here. They were no longer slaves. They could not be sold, and they were not owned bodily by any individual. But they had no land. And the only thing they knew was farming. So what did they have to do was to hire themselves out back to the same landowner. But then he could arrange terms on his own. So the conditions were still very difficult. Sure, some land reforms were made and certain little land was given to the peasants. But never in sufficient quantity. And they didn't have the tools with which to work. that they could never accumulate, for example, enough wealth to purchase more land. So that the longer they lived, the longer the families existed, and the more they developed, the more land poor they became. You might wonder why. Well, when a son got married, what could his parents give him? The only thing they could give him was a piece of land. So whatever land they had, they kept dividing and subdividing and subdividing until finally there was nothing left to subdivide. And they would have to hire themselves out as chattel labor. They would work a little bit on their field the rest of the time. They would work, go to work for the rich landowner. Or in the winter time, he had exhausted all the little food that he could raise on his land. He would have to go then work for the rich farmer or the rich landowner. And how rich they were, that my father tells me about the lands that were owned by a rich absentee landowner who was never seen in this village on these lands by my father or his father or his father. He never visited these lands. And yet he was the one that was making all the money out of these people. They had overseers. And you'd hire yourself out then in the wintertime to do whatever chores that were needed, to repair things and stuff. You didn't get paid in money, but you were paid in food for doing this work. Or if you couldn't, or if you didn't have time to work on his land, if you wanted, you could go and get food from him. What would they borrow? Flour. No meat, flour. Then if you had a lot of cows, you'd get milk. And then during the summertime, in exchange for which they had to work a certain number of days on his fields. So that they'd work on this landowner's fields during the day. And then on the days off or late at night, they would work on their own little plots of land to raise what little food that they could. And how rough life was. I hope to take one of these machines home and have sit down and just have my father tell me these things, because most of these I remember, but many of them I'm afraid I will forget, and there's no point trusting my memory. My father is 78 years old now, and I think I'd like to get a lot of this down. For example, he relates a story. He was the oldest boy in the family. There were 9 children altogether, 5 boys and 4 girls. But he was the oldest boy, and he was already a young man. He tells one story, for example, that his mother would wake him up long before daybreak, but his mother was awake long before that. He would awaken him so that he could rub the potatoes on, what do you call this thing, you know, when you want to make potatoes? On the grater. And he would rub all the potatoes on the grater, all the potatoes, that she could make potato pancakes for breakfast before the others got up. There were 9 children in the family, all of whom were always hungry, plus 2 adults. You can imagine how many potatoes she would peel. And he would have to grate them down. Then the mother, as he was grating, the mother would make potato pancakes, the other would be awake, and they'd have breakfast. And then in a small cloth, she would wrap up some of these pancakes, and they would take them with them to the field. And at lunchtime, that would be their lunch, but cold this time. When they came back at supper time, there would be the remainder of the pancakes, plus a little sour cream, or if there wasn't any sour cream, well then she would cut up into small pieces, fat back, heat it up and melt it down and pour it over the pancakes, and that would be their supper. So he often said about potatoes, and we mentioned that in the restaurant here you can get scalloped potatoes or something like that. He said, that's a fancy name, he said, but I'm sure we had it, because if there's any shape or form in which potatoes can be eaten, we ate them. Because you had them for breakfast, you had them for lunch, and you had them for supper. And it was always sunk in a different, slightly different way. Either they were baked, or they were mashed, or they were put in pierogies, as you, many of you have heard about. Or they were made into pancakes, because this they could raise a great deal on, it was easy to store. So you eat potatoes. And the peculiar part of it is that neither he nor I, and people out there in our life, we never get tired of potatoes, by the way. We still like potatoes. There are other things that I can get along with up. Potatoes we still can eat. Through these kind of little anecdotes and little stories, I'm trying to get a picture across to you of the life these people have to live. and why it was easy, relatively easy, to get people pick themselves up, go beyond an ocean to a land by which they never heard. We talk about pioneers, to a land where everything was going to be strange to them, including the language and the thing. So these pioneers took a great deal of courage, leaving their families behind, never knowing whether they're going to ever come back. They weren't sure they're going to make it in the first place, and about never being certain of going coming back. They came here with one purpose in mind: to make enough money to go back to purchase enough land on which he can live. That was the sole purpose of their coming over here. To make enough money to go back and buy land on which to live. I'm talking about the overwhelming majority. There were certain small percentage of these people who were leaving that country knowing full well they didn't want to come back here again. Now, this was kind of like, there were peasants. You worked from before sunup until after long after dark. The only light that they could have was by candle light. No such thing as kerosene, even our lamps. Candle light. They lived in huts with straw thatched roofs. These houses still exist over there. It's been my good fortune to go back to the village in which I was born three times in my lifetime. I was there the first time in 1947, and then in 1959 and 1961. And I also feel very fortunate that I was able to visit the house in which I was born. I even have a picture of my son sitting on the bed, which stands exactly in the same corner where the bed stood when I was a little boy, and on which I stood when my grandmother was dressing me to come when we were leaving the Ukraine. And the reason it remained in a child's mind, I was barely 4 years old then, was that my mother's grandmother was crying very bitterly. And because my father had gone 3 years before that, I never remember my father when I got here. I was only barely a year old when my father left. So thus, most of the time was spent with my grandmother and my aunt. So that when she was crying so bitterly, I felt very, very badly about it. And things like this, pictures remain indelibly fixed in the child's mind. And because I could remember my grandmother, I could remember the background there, so I could remember the room, what it looked like. So when I went back, I wanted to take a picture of my son sitting on the same bed. Not on the same bed, but the bed is standing in the same corner on which I stood when my grandmother was dressing him. And it still has a thatched roof over it. They still build those kind of houses, mud walls. They don't put thatched roofs on. It's tile now or tin. But they still build the houses in the same way. Because they feel that the first place, as they say, is going to stand for 100 years, and it's cool in the summer and warm in the winter when they make it. The walls are this thick. It's a special clay, and they learn how to mix it specially, and they really stand up, these houses. But usually there were two-room houses, and in the wintertime, in the second room, were the cows, the pigs, and the chickens. And you were in one room, and they were right next door in the other room. Because there was no other place to keep them in the wintertime. They would freeze. And I know stories, my mother tells me, how they would have to care for their animals, because their life depended on it. Every so often, sometimes an animal will eat the wrong kind of food. Mrs. Butts about all that, because she was raised on a farm. You know, they get terribly gassed and get blown up to do something. At the mother of the household crying over the cow and saying, "Why couldn't I have gotten sick instead of you, our feeder?" The mother would have rather gotten sick than the cow. So all of these, they come to mind, will help fill in the picture. That's why they share the house with you in the wintertime. Because without them, you had no assurance of being able to live. This is your main supply source of food. Cows especially, because that gave you milk. From milk you would get butter, you would get cheese, buttermilk, sour milk, with which then you could embellish the potatoes that you were going to eat. And these are the three bases. They never killed a cow. Never. Not for meat. Meat was a rarity. You got it maybe once a year or twice a year after high holidays. What they did raise for meat food were pigs and poultry, chickens, ducks, and geese. And you can see also why. Chickens are fairly easy to keep alive and feed. Ducks are fairly easy and geese. They have to send them on the pasture. Maybe they could scavenge, they would get them. And the pigs were primarily fed with what we would call garbage. What was left over from the table. And very coarse grain and things of that sort. That's all they were fed. But these were raised then because they were easy to raise. And the meat was from that. So they were killed usually in the early winter or late winter, where they could be kept frozen for a while. First they would be salted and kept frozen, and the meat would appear for the first time after Easter. And you had meat only as long as it lasted after Easter, because it was Lent before that, you couldn't eat it. These were religious people. And you had meat as long as it lasted, and that's all you had of meat. And what you couldn't or wouldn't eat, you would sell so that you could buy such essentials as salt and matches. They were extremely valuable. Salt and matches. These people needed. They had very little schooling. At best, they could get 3 or 4 years of schooling. Many of them got no schooling at all, because just as soon as they got old enough to help to work, either on their own fields, and if they worked on their own fields, they could release then some older hands to go to work on the landowner's field. Therefore, having more of an income and having that much more to eat, they have to go to work. Or if they were old enough, even to tend the cow, watch the cow in the pasture. That would be the job of young children. And that was the job of my mother, because she was the oldest in the family. My mother is an illiterate. She can neither read nor write, because she was the oldest member in the family. And just as soon as she got old enough, she had to go and help in the fields. Her father left the Ukraine fairly early to work in Germany, and she had to go then help her mother. And in the first period, her father in the field. And besides, her father had that time around kind of approaches of many other people. He said, you're a girl, you're going to grow up to be a woman, you're going to get married, you're going to have a husband. What do you need to read or write for anyhow? You go out and work in the fields, because they needed the help. This could be multiplied 10,000-fold. Now, this is the life that the people have to live. No schooling, no medical care, because you couldn't afford it.